Good afternoon, Juno. It's 2:59 p.m. I'm Ken Fix, your host for a Juno Afternoon today. Full show today. Adi Nessia from Aware Choose Respect March will be here to talk about her event. We'll find out about tonight and Wednesday night's, that's tonight, public lecture and film on toxic chemicals with guests Dr. Tracy Woodruff and Pam Miller. We'll get a preview of the music of Harrison B. He'll be performing an Alaska Originals concert Thursday night at 6:30 on, Thursday night on 360 North. We'll talk with Shelley Gill about her new children's book, Alaska Dog Heroes. We'll get the details on this week's early learning conference with guest Joy Lyon and keynote speaker Diana Werrell-Grabowski. We'll get an update from our hometown ski area, Eagle Crest. All this, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more. Today on a Juno Afternoon, stay with us. National Native News is up first.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The last of the special hearings by Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission are set to take place in Alberta. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, many Aboriginal people are now asking what happens next.
The Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearings, more than half a dozen of them in different parts of the country over the past 2 years, were part of the settlement between Native leaders, the Canadian government, and churches to finally put to rest the lingering pain of the residential school era. It was an opportunity for the victims of the schools to tell their stories and for some possibly to find closure. From the late 1800s to the late 1900s, tens of thousands of Aboriginal children across the country were forcibly taken from their homes and sent to the residential schools to be assimilated into white society. But thousands were sexually, physically, and emotionally abused. Many stories of pain have been recounted over the past 2 years. Now, many ask, what next? Gabrielle Scrimshaw is the co-founder of the Aboriginal Professional Association of Canada.
Reconciliation does not just involve Indigenous people of this country speaking their truths. It involves a much larger process of honoring those truths through our educational system moving forward and resetting the relationship and understanding our shared history as Canadians.
The Truth and Reconciliation Commission has a mandate to learn the truth about what happened and to inform all Canadians about it. This week, it hosts its final national event in Edmonton. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Native people recently met in Spokane, Washington, to discuss options to increase salmon runs in the Columbia River. The talks are aimed at getting such discussions included in treaty negotiations between the U.S. and Canada. Steve Jackson has more.
The Columbia River Treaty is up for possible renegotiation beginning this fall. The 1964 treaty between the U.S. and Canada focused mostly on electrical generation and flood control. But now tribal leaders want to make sure salmon recovery is part of any new document. For the Spokane tribe, salmon was a very important part of the culture. The fish were permanently cut off from reaching the confluence of the Spokane and Columbia Rivers in 1942 with the arrival of Grand Coulee Dam. Matt Wynn is with the Spokane Tribal Council, who says restoring those runs would bring a renaissance to their way of life.
It would mean a return to our cultural beginnings. I mean, for time immemorial, we were a salmon people. And even the hand gesture for tribes that didn't know our language or didn't know what to call them, they would do the gesture of a fish and then to their mouth, salmon eaters.
15 U.S. tribes and several from Canada are pushing to see fish passage established at the Grand Coulee Dam. Ideas discussed at the conference included older concepts like trucking returning salmon around the dam, as well as new technology like a giant vacuum system that would suck fish over. Wynn says that they've received no feedback yet from the U.S. State Department, which would negotiate the treaty with Canada, but the British Columbian government has said it does not want salmon restoration to be part of the negotiations over a new treaty. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
The Senate Committee on Indian Affairs is focusing on President Obama's 2015 budget. Tribal and federal officials are scheduled to testify at today's hearing in Washington, D.C. The proposal includes more than $2 billion for Indian Affairs, which the administration says is an increase from 2014. According to the White House, the request fully funds contract support costs, addresses poverty in education, and includes other initiatives for Indian country. During this week in 2013, more than 200 young people from Quebec First Nations finished a nearly 1,000-mile journey to Ottawa. Their trek was inspired by the Idle No More movement. Issues they raised in Canada's capital included preserving Native language, culture, and traditions. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. The Convention and Tourism Department of the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce provides convention and event planning services for Native American organizations. Information at ahcnm.org. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Welcome back to a Juno afternoon. It's 3:05 p.m. My first guest is Adi Nesia from the AWARE group, and she's going to tell us about a couple events coming up. Hi, Adi. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome.
So I am here to share with you the opportunity of the Choose Respect March, which is taking place tomorrow at the steps of the Capitol, part of Governor Parnell's Choose Respect initiative. And over 170 communities are gathering around Alaska and envisioning a world and a state free of domestic violence and sexual assault, and marching and supporting both victims and initiatives to really be that change.
This is going to be tomorrow then.
Yeah, so come on right down to the steps of the Capitol at noon tomorrow, and we'll march from the Capitol to Marine Park, and there'll be some inspirational speakers and some light snacks and refreshments and lots of good people coming out together.
All right, Adi, and what else did you have coming up?
Well, as part of Sexual Assault Awareness Month, we have a number of events happening throughout the month as well. So Healing Arts exhibit at Silver Bow First Friday. We're doing some Healthy Relationships class for teens in early April. So our entire calendar of events can be found both through the JAC and through AWARE's website if you want more information. A month full of activities, but starting off with the Choose Respect March tomorrow. And our website is www.awareak.org.
Okay, Adi, thank you very much for being my guest in the studio.
Thank you for having us. See you all tomorrow.
You're welcome. Okay.
This is Bird Note. Let's assume for a moment that you have a yard that a pair of robins has nested in for 12 years. You may be surprised to learn that it hasn't always been the same pair. Mortality rate is high in our familiar songbirds. For robins, it's around 50% each year once young birds have fledged. If a robin survives to midwinter, it lives an average of 1.7 years after that. The oldest robins in your yard might be about 6 years old, although one banded bird lived almost 14 years. So in a dozen years, you've probably had at least a half dozen robins of each sex involved in nesting. Robins, and most other migratory birds, don't maintain their pair bonds over winter, so they mate anew each spring. But if the same male and female return to the same territory, they're very likely to mate again. If the male has died, another male will likely take over the territory, and the living female may mate with him. Similarly, if the female has died, a new female will mate with the resident male. They may nest in the same shrub, if it's a favorable nesting spot, and to our eyes, it looks as if the same pair of robins has returned. To learn more, come to birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
Welcome back to a Juno afternoon. My guests now are Dr. Tracy Woodruff and Pam Miller, and they're going to talk about tonight's public lecture and film on toxic chemicals. Welcome both of you to the studio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Toxic chemicals. I know this organization was founded in 1997, I believe. Yeah. Nodding your heads. Yes. Okay, great.
Yeah. Reaction toxic.
Okay. And it was because Alaskans wanted assistance with environmental concerns and contaminants that were there?
Yes. We address environmental health concerns. We work on policy issues. We assist communities and do community-based research. And we're here in Juneau to promote this event that we're sponsoring, a lecture series with Dr. Tracy Woodruff with the University of California, San Francisco's Program on Reproductive Health and the Environment. And there's going to be a free lecture tonight at 6:30 called Generations at Risk, followed by a film screening of an award-winning documentary film called Toxic Hot Seat at 7:45 at the Goldtown Nickelodeon Theater.
All right. And what types of contaminants are most often discovered here in Alaska, and how did they get there?
Well, we have several different problems happening right now. We have industrial sites that include oil and gas facilities as well as mining facilities. We also have military sites. Alaska has over 700 formerly used defense sites. Many of those sites have very persistent and toxic chemicals such as PCBs and pesticides and heavy metals. And then we're also situated in the north, so we're on the receiving end for the global transport of chemical contaminants from really all over the hemisphere. We're a hemispheric sink for chemical contaminants, and these arise on wind and ocean currents and are ultimately deposited in the north in the Arctic environment, where they accumulate in the food web, so people are disproportionately exposed that way as well.
Okay, so does this involve any of the stuff that we had, like when the Japanese had the earthquake and lots of contaminants came loose? Not only that, but docks and boats and whatnot, and flotsam and jetsam, everything eventually winds up coming into the Gulf of Alaska and, you know, getting into our shorelines. Is that part of the problem that your group addresses?
Well, we are very concerned about what happened with the Fukushima incident and the radiation that is leaking into the Pacific Ocean there, and I think there's not a lot of information yet about the radiation levels that might be off Alaska's coast. So I think there needs to be a lot more information gathered about that.
Do you know if anybody's testing for that yet, or what are we...
There is a program through Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute that is testing that, and we're planning to have an informational series about that coming up on our Collaborative on Health and the Environment program.
Okay, Dr. Woodruff, you haven't said anything yet. Can you tell us a little bit about your involvement and what the film is tonight that they're running?
Yeah, so I came here to Alaska because while I work in California in the lower 48, I came to Alaska to talk about not only the chemicals that are exposed to here, Alaskans are exposed to here, but that other people in the United States are also exposed to at the same time. So there's a host of different industrial chemicals that are manufactured and produced every day, and they get into many of our products. The film tonight is going to talk about some of the chemicals that are used in furniture, things like that have been used, like polybrominated diphenyl ethers or the chemical tris. Some of these chemicals have been used because they were designed to create anti-flammability, but they actually haven't always been that effective, nor have they also been found to be that healthy for people to be exposed to. So, for example, polybrominated diphenyl ethers, which is one of the chemicals that has been used heavily, particularly in California, in polyurethane foam, people can be exposed to that, and we now measure it in people everywhere in the United States. And in California, for example, we measure them even more in Californians. And the big challenge that we have is that some of these chemicals, or actually we know many of these chemicals, people are exposed to them, not only regular people, but also pregnant women and children. And we have an extra concern about that, because if you get exposed during pregnancy or childhood, when things are developing, like your brain, your lungs, or other parts of your body, that can have some kind of adverse consequence on your development. So polybrominated diphenyl ethers is a great example, because we've seen now that studies show that, well, early studies showed that exposure to some of these chemicals can adversely affect neurodevelopment in animals. We're now seeing the same thing in humans. And so, fortunately, PBDEs, polybrominated diphenyl ethers, were actually, some of them were banned in California and been phased out in the United States, but they were replaced with other chemicals. And now there's a focus on replacing these chemicals generally with other measures to both improve flammability but also reduce the use of toxic chemicals in furniture.
Mm-hmm. Okay, are these mostly coming from U.S. manufacturers or foreign manufacturers or both?
I'd say
both.
So you're
shaking your head, both. Okay.
I'd say both, and I think one of the problems that we'd like to address is that there's this sort of pattern that the chemical manufacturers use of unfortunate substitution. So the PBDEs that Tracy spoke about have and are being phased out. However, they've been largely replaced by a class of chemicals known as chlorinated TRIS compounds, and some of these compounds are known to be carcinogenic and mutagenic, and yet they're in a lot of the common household products that we have, like nursing pads, nap mats, children's furniture, as well as couches and other mattresses that we use in our homes.
This seems like it's a lot harder to detect than just the lead paint that's coming from some of the foreign manufacturers that winds up on children's toys and stuff like that. We're talking some things that are pretty well hidden, it looks like, in everyday items. Is that
Yeah, and I think that is a problem that we want to address, because the manufacturers are not required to disclose the contents of their products. And so that's one thing that we work to achieve is full disclosure and the right to know that people have.
Yeah, the other thing is, too, is that a lot of these chemicals, actually many of these chemicals that are used not just in furniture but other products, they aren't required to be tested for their potential to adversely affect health before mm-hmm. they're used in products and go on to the marketplace. So it's not like drugs, right? When your doctor prescribes a drug for you, you know that it's gone through a lot of testing to make sure that it's both safe and efficacious for use for whatever that disease is. But the way the laws are set up in the United States, there's not a requirement that chemicals that are used, whether they're in furniture or in children's toys or cleaning products or other things in your home, there's no requirement that these chemicals be fully tested for how they might impact children or pregnant women or even other people in the United States. And so things are used with some intended purpose, but they may have an unintended consequence, and people don't even know because the chemicals haven't even been thoroughly tested.
Okay, and are some of these things that you're finding, are these cheaper substitutes for ingredients that manufacturers would put in their products? In other words, I can cut my costs and increase my profit margin by using this versus that. Is any of that going on, or?
Well, I would say that manufacturers are probably using the chemicals that they think meet certain requirements for their performance that they're trying to achieve. They want it to be cheap. They want it to have certain properties when they sell it. But there's no requirement to also make sure that that chemical is not going to be hazardous for children and pregnant women when they use it in their products. So right now, it's not, I mean, they might do some testing on it, but it's not required to basically prove safety before they use it in their product.
And I think it is true that there are many viable and safer alternatives, alternative materials, alternative technologies like barrier technologies that can be used to prevent flammability, but that don't confer the toxicity that we're concerned about, that children are exposed to in household dust, because these chemicals don't stay in the polyurethane foam. They leach out, they get out into the dust, into the air, and children are very vulnerable and exposed to these chemicals that way.
Yeah, there was a study in California that found that children, small children, like 2 to 3 years old, because they're still crawling around and the PBDEs get out of the couch, they get into the dust, and they're crawling around, so they're putting their hands in the dust and then, you know, putting their hands in their mouth, that they had levels of PBDEs in their bodies that were similar to people who work occupationally with these chemicals. So we can see high exposures from leaching out from, the chemicals weren't intended to be in the dust, but they can get out of the couch, get into the dust, and then they can expose kids. And again, we know something about PBDEs, but for many of the other chemicals that might be used in these couches, they could be a problem if they're exposed. And I think it puts a burden on families because they want to know, well, if I buy a couch in the store, is it going to be okay for my family?
Okay. That brought me to two other questions I had, is where are we likely to run into these toxins and what steps can we take to avoid them?
Well, the thing is that industrial chemicals that are manufactured and used in the United States, they may show up in any of the products that we have in our home. So whether it's couches, they could be used in the lining of materials that we keep our food in. They can be in personal care products. They can be in cleaning materials, in the building materials that are used to make our home. So there, I think that a point that Pam brought up is that there's actually not a requirement to know where they're all used. So at some level, we're kind of operating with one of our hands behind our back in terms of trying to tell you, well, I know exactly where they're all used because there's not a requirement to disclose all that information. But things can people can do simple things to reduce their exposure to some of these chemicals. I know that ACAD has information on their website, as well as we do, about tips that people can take to reduce their exposures. But there's simple things that you do every day or recommended every day. So eat lower on the food chain, because some of these chemicals can migrate into fat and you can get exposed through food. Washing your hands or keeping the levels of dust low in your house can also be helpful. These are some very simple things that people can do that don't cost any money. But one of the challenges is that it puts the burden on us to try and figure out like where they are and to reduce the exposures. And really, what would be better is if when we go to the store and we bought something, that it we knew it had already been tested, so we don't have to worry about trying to figure out what chemicals are in it and whether we have to do something to reduce exposures to us or our children.
Okay, and please remind everybody where and when the screening is of Toxic Hot Seat.
Yes, so Dr. Woodruff will be giving a lecture at 6:30 called Generations at Risk, and then the film screening of the documentary film Toxic Hot Seat will be at 7:45. Both of these things at the Goldtown Nickelodeon Theater at 171 Shattuck Way here in Juneau. So we're really happy to be here, and we also are here to support Senate Bill 151, the Toxic Free Children's Act, which was introduced by Senator Donnie Olson, which requires a listing of chemicals of high concern to children, which I think is an important step in the right direction. And it also moves to phase out some of the toxic flame retardants known as chlorinated trists that are found in children's products.
Okay. Well, Dr. Tracy Woodruff and Pam Miller, thank you very much for being my guests in the studio today.
All right. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
And now, before I bring my next guest in, Harrison B., I'm going to play one of his songs. This is called Carry You, and Harrison will be in with me in about 3 minutes.
You will find time in a lifetime to when the storm is gone through, and that water overflowing and an honesty. In the clamp down, in the pour, we'll band new. Yeah, put that water, if you let it, they're gonna carry you. To the people, yeah. To the evil, to the scared, and we'll see the brew. Yeah, and to the oceans, overflowing without a new. Righteous living, sudden giver, prejudice they can't refuse. That water, if you let it, they're gonna carry you. And they're untold, you're singing, they need a washing anew. And you cling to the ground, have to put up the storm. But let go when you know you're gonna drown, yeah. When you let go and you let go, yeah, when you let that water. Well, my brothers and my sisters, you know that I cannot prove, but with the healing I do believe is in the living. This type of thing I do believe is being true. So the next time that you go out and when you find time where there is some drowning to do, you let your troubles do your healing. You let them carry you. And they're untold. You're singing. You need a washing anew. And you cling to the ground. After what I did, the storm runs through. But let go, you know you're gonna drown. Yeah. When you let go and you let go. The way you let that water. Good people are gonna.
Yeah.
You need a washing anew, and you cling to the ground as the weather, the storm will do. Yeah, but you let go, and you know you gon' try. Yeah, go on, you let go, and you let know. But you let that water do your healing. You let it carry you. You let your troubles do your healing, and they're gonna carry. Lord, I know they're gonna carry you. Yes,
welcome back to Juno Afternoon. It's 3:25. This is Ken Fix. I'm your host for today, and my guest now is Harrison B., who I'm very much appreciative of being given the opportunity to talk to him. Harrison, how are you?
It's good to be here, Ken. I'm a little sleepy. I just got off the plane, but I'm doing all right, man. How about yourself?
Oh, did you have the overnight through Seattle?
Well, no, I came out of Chicago, but I started in Syracuse yesterday, so it's been a good little jaunt.
Wow, you're getting a frequent flyer miles.
Trying to.
Okay, you're going to be performing on 360 North,
mm-hmm.
and that's going to be tomorrow evening.
Yep, tomorrow.
Alaska Originals concert. Actually, our studio here is, you know, it's kind of, well, I wouldn't say it's brand new, but it's pretty new. So,
sure.
You know, we're very happy to have you.
Well, I'm excited to be there. That's the space, if y'all don't know about it, it's just a state-of-the-art television studio you guys got here, and it's going to be a really nice production. I'm excited to be a part of it, Tickle Pink, too, and, you know, I'm hoping to share it with a lot of good people tomorrow night.
Okay, now I've heard about three tracks off your CD so far, and this was recorded live in one take in Las Casas.
Yes, Las Casas, and we were talking, you're familiar with
Martinsboro. My wife and I were in Smyrna from 97 to 2010, so it was about 13 years down just south of Nashville, but I love that city.
Sure.
Nashville's
oh,
fabulous.
So, yeah, it's about equal distance on the other side. Smyrna, Murfreesboro, Las Casas is.
Yeah, it's about 15
further.
Miles yeah. away from Smyrna,
mm-hmm.
so I'm very familiar with the area.
So that's my hometown, and it's a general store I grew up going to on Saturday mornings with my dad, and I just wanted to do a recording in a meaningful place, and so that's kind of how the album came to be. So.
And this was recorded in one take live?
One take, yeah. We planned it to do three takes. We always wanted the concept of start to finish, the microphones not stopping, and it being immersive where you felt like you were in the room the whole time. And we thought maybe from three takes that we could chop it and, you know, make it appear to be one. But in reality, what happened is the first two takes were terrible. We didn't get anything. And so it came down to the third take where a live audience was going to be there, and we had to nail it, and, you know, I think we got absolutely what we were in there to get, and it ended up being a true-to-form, one-take live recording that, you know, I'm pretty proud of it, to be honest.
Okay, and your brand of music, you're calling this Progressive American Soul,
mm-hmm.
but rooted in Alaska.
It is, in a lot of ways. I cut my teeth right here, starting out in this city. I spend a lot of time up here. After I leave Juneau, I'll go north. I'll tour up there for about 5 weeks, and working in conjunction with the Aurora Project here out of town. They've been supportive of me for a little while now, and so, you know, it's just one of those things where at this point this is a second home, and I couldn't be happier to call it, and I couldn't be happier to share some of the stories tomorrow night about how kind of I've been rooted in this state. So it's been good to me.
Okay, go ahead and spin a few stories here. We got a couple minutes.
Sure. I came up originally. I graduated college out of Nashville, and I had been playing country for a long time, and I just was a little bit over it, and I kind of put the guitar down, and I wanted to go as far away from what I'd known as I could, and, you know, when you're from down there, nothing's more paradigm-shifting than thinking of Alaska, and I knew one person, and I asked them where I should get a job, and they told me the zip line over here on South Douglas, and so I did. I interviewed and went online, did the thing, and drove 4,300 miles and just came, just packed my Jeep up and came, worked about 6 months as a bartender to make the money to make the drive, and once I got here, I started playing open mics again, and realized that it didn't all have to be country, because there were so many other musics that were up here that, quite frankly, I just hadn't been introduced to yet, properly anyway. And once I really started playing and kind of rekindled my love right here in this very city, and then I went home, and that's when I went back to work, really, and kind of turned it into an album, that sort of thing. And I brought it back, and I have spent equal time here and there ever since, and it's just been an unbelievable blessing to me to be able to come to this state and share this music with a lot of people that now are friends, and kind of grow these relationships and continue to grow as an artist as well in this state. And I got some music about this state. I got songs, many that I've written in this state, and it's just a very inspiring place to me. So I think I'll always hold Alaska as home, you know, in a lot of ways.
Okay, did was Music Row kind of a turnoff down there? Or because sure. I know a lot of people that left the recording industry in California mm-hmm. to come to Nashville because they liked the environment there.
It was to me. I think I got kind of shepherded into the commercial aspect very early on, working with artist development firms when I was just 18 years old, just coming into college. And in ways that, quite frankly, I realized that there wasn't going to be anything original in it for me. And I think there was always a part of me that really wanted to be expressive in an artistic way that I felt like was just getting squeezed out of me. And think about a state, I still wouldn't be doing what I do. But as it stands, Alaska is really what gave me the freedom to be able to pursue it my own way. So.
Okay, like I was telling you, I've been up here for 5 years now, and mm-hmm. I'm thriving here.
Sure.
I mean, some of it is what you make of it. I mean, you could just sit around and just do a job and you know, not have anything else happen in your life. But, you know, I get involved in plenty of things. I work for the planetarium here. I do work here on the radio station. So I'm kind of out and about.
Sure.
And I find that getting integrated into a community really... it just opens you up. You get a lot better perspective rather than just the same people that you work with, and then you go back to your apartment or whatever, and, you know, that's your life.
Right.
That's kind of a not a really cool life if that's all you see.
Sure.
But it seems like that's broadened your experiences as well, getting out there and doing things and getting into different social circles.
Sure.
It just really expands who you are.
Absolutely. And, you know, even if nothing else, And that's not all that there is to it, but my view on Nashville is totally different now. I still live in that city. I still live there, and I love it now because I kind of gave it a chance to breathe, and it's now what I want it to be, you know what I'm saying, as opposed to having to play it by their rules. And so
right.
Couldn't be happier and more blessed by Juneau, by Alaska on the whole, and just the whole way you guys do things. And I'm excited to be here. It's still kind of waking up to the fact that I'm here. Like I said, I was on the East Coast as of yesterday evening, so... It's all kind of new.
Right, again. But all these things in your experiences color what you do. And I'm sure that your CD, this is all a byproduct of the experiences that you've had over the last several years.
Well, absolutely. And this place has given me an opportunity to keep going when a lot of other places maybe wouldn't. And it's kept me alive to the point now where, you know, I'm just excited to still be wanted here in terms of playing music and get the opportunities to come back and put it on for whoever it is that wants to listen. So... It's just been a blessing over and over again.
Oh, you're certainly welcome to be here. And, you know, it's like you tell somebody that, well, where do you live? And you don't want to tell them it's like Las Casas. You want to say, well, Nashville.
Sure.
Because it's like, you know, where I was in the suburbs, you know, like 20 miles south of the city. And
mm-hmm.
people would say, oh, you like country music? It's like, well, there's a lot more in Nashville than just country music.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, you know, there's a whole other environment that's there. It's not just the music genre.
Oh, Lord.
So, it's, again, you know, some people think, oh, you're from here. It's like, you know, I'm from Houston. Oh, you're into the oil industry? Or, you know, it's certain areas people will naturally associate with you, you know, to be in a certain industry, or, you know, they type you into a genre from, you know, this is where you're from.
Sure.
So that's why it's kind of, you know, finding soul music that, you know, this is rooted in, you know, Las Casas,
sure.
which is 15 miles from Smyrna, which
mm-hmm.
is, you know, it's pretty close to I-24, and you just take the road up northwest, and you're in Nashville in about, you know, 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's just kind of fascinating to me that you've got such a draw in here towards Alaska and that you really fell in love with it, and you just love being here.
I do. I really do. So, it's just... You know, when I've always said, and I continue to say, when I was first starting out in this, I would have never pictured myself spending as much time in Alaska or being in love with it the way that I am. But it's just one of those things where life, it does some funny things sometimes. And to be honest, your imagination is too limited to be able to provide the greatness that life can bring. And I couldn't be happier with the way it's played out or happier to be here. And it's not getting old saying that. I'll just put it that way.
All right. You want me to plug this, or you want to do it?
You go ahead and do it. Can
okay. Harrison B. is going to be here at the KTOO studios tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. The doors open at 6:30, and this is going to be a live television broadcast recording. It's $12 for tickets. They're available here at the studio, or go to ktoo.org, or it's $15 at the door. And is some of this down at Brown's?
Is this
close to your set list, or you got something a little bit more expansive than this?
I do. I've got a couple of songs that are written exclusively about Alaska that I'll be working into the set. A lot off that album there. The first hour is going to be all originals, and the goal tomorrow evening is to really share a lot of the stories behind the music as well, what I'm going for, what I meant, or where I was coming from. And then we'll have a brief break, and then on the backside I'll play a couple of noted covers that were very iconic to me and kind of helped to shape me as an artist and push me in certain ways, and also finish out the set with some other original material. So it's about 2 hours of just music, man. That's all there's to it. And there'll be beer and wine here as well. Alaskan Brewing's on board. They're in support, as is Aurora Project there. I'll have some t-shirts from those guys with some local merchandise too, and it's just going to be a good evening.
All right, Harrison B., wonderful to meet you, and thank you very much for being our guest in the studio today.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 26th of March, 2014. It's the birthday of Tennessee Williams, the playwright, born Thomas Williams, Columbus, Mississippi, 1911. He was attending the University of Missouri in 1929, when he saw a production of Henrik Ibsen's Ghosts, and that decided him on becoming a playwright. He had to go to work at the International Shoe Company in St. Louis, and there he worked with another young man whose name was Stanley Kowalski. Tennessee Williams started out writing plays for small local theater companies that got good reviews, and then The Glass Menagerie came along in 1944, which was a big success in Chicago and then on Broadway. And his next major play, A Streetcar Named Desire, 1947, including a character named Stanley Kowalski. It's the birthday of Robert Frost, born San Francisco, 1874. His father died of tuberculosis. The mother moved the family to Lawrence, Massachusetts, where Robert's paternal grandparents lived. The boy went to Dartmouth, left after a couple of months, came back home, worked odd jobs, believed that his true calling was that of a poet. After his first poem was published, he proposed to his high school sweetheart, Eleanor. She turned him down. She wanted to finish college. He made a surprise visit to present her with a collection of his poems. She asked him to leave. He thought about suicide. He took a train south to the Great Dismal Swamp between Virginia and North Carolina, walked 10 miles into the heart of the swamp, met a group of duck hunters, paid them $1 to take him out. Eleanor graduated. He proposed to her again, and she accepted. A few years later, his grandfather presented the Frosts with a 30-acre farm in Derry in New Hampshire. It had a nice farmhouse. There was a barn, an apple orchard, pastures, a big vegetable garden, and the grandfather insisted that Robert Frost accept a live-in farmhand, Carl Burrell, who milked the cows each morning and packed the eggs and tended the apples. And that gave Robert Frost time to write his poems. When his first books came out, A Boy's Will in 1913 and North of Boston in 1914, the books that made Robert Frost famous, most of the poems in those two books had been written at the farm in Derry, New Hampshire, the gift from his grandfather. Frost wrote in a letter, "The core of all my writing was probably the 5 free years I had there on the farm when I had time and seclusion." Here's a poem by Robert Frost on his birthday, A Prayer in Spring. Oh, give us pleasure in the flowers today, and give us not to think so far away as the uncertain harvest. Keep us here, all simply in the springing of the year. Oh, give us pleasure in the orchard white, like nothing else by day, like ghosts by night, and make us happy in the happy bees, the swarm dilating round the perfect trees. And make us happy in the darting bird that suddenly above the bees is heard, the meteor that thrusts in with needle bill and off a blossom in midair stand still. For this is love, and nothing else is love, the which it is reserved for God above to sanctify to what far ends he will, but which it only needs that we fulfill. A Prayer in Spring by Robert Frost, from his collected poems, prose, and plays, published by the Library of America, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Welcome back to a Juno Afternoon. It's 3:40 p.m. I'm Ken Fix, your host, and with me now are my guests, Joy Lyon and Dr. Diana Grabowski. Welcome both of you to the studio.
Thanks, Ken.
Okay, now give us some of the details on this week's Early Learning Conference.
All right. Well, we're really excited about it. It's on science, technology, engineering, and math for young children. And so it's happening here at Centennial Hall on all day Friday and all day Saturday. And early educators from all over Southeast Alaska are coming in. And we even have some from up in the northern region as well. And parents are also invited. And especially we're having a Friday family night, Friday evening from 6 to 7. On water, 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 which we haven't seen very much of lately, but we know it's still coming.
Oh, well, you don't realize that in this town, April and May are kind of the nicest months. This is when we get the least amount of rain. So actually, April and May are pretty nice. So if you ever want to come visit here, not that all the tourist things are open, but April and May are actually pretty good.
That's why
anytime
we
after the 4th of July, the sky opens up about every other day, and we just start getting rain. And then by September, it's just rain.
So Dr. Diana just arrived this afternoon from Florida, so this is a little bit of a cold shock for her, but we're excited that she's here, and she's presented all over the country on STEM for early childhood. And so, you know, looking for who would be the best person to present, you know, her name just kept coming up over and over again. So really excited that she could come all the way up.
And I'm excited to be here. So,
yes, we're happy to have you. And you're going to be talking about some hands-on activities in science, technology, engineering, and math.
Yeah, my keynote is basically the importance of nurturing curiosity in the young child. And I'm actually going to start off the keynote with just making sure that teachers themselves are curious, because if teachers are not curious themselves, the students are looking at the teachers for their curiosity, so they're modeling. So curiosity is the basis of scientific inquiry, and STEM is the process of doing science, technology, engineering, and math. So the keynote's an interactive keynote, meaning that teachers are actually going to be manipulating materials throughout the hour and 15-minute session. We have mealworms who are going to be working with polymers. They're going to be measuring things. So instead of me just getting up there lecturing, I'm going to basically be modeling methods for them to use in their classroom to make sure that they nurture the young child's, you know, natural curiosity. What happens is once children get beyond early childhood, curiosity is usually stifled because of testing and just the traditional classroom. So we need to keep that curiosity alive, the creativity, and that's the basis of it. But it's going to be a very high-level keynote.
Okay. We're not going to be, like, dropping magnesium in water or anything like
no
that.
No magnesium in
explosion.
Water.
Anybody, yeah, I was going to say that you guys know what that does, right?
But
yeah.
It is going to be really hands-on. Okay. I mean, every workshop session, there are about 25 different workshop sessions for people to choose from, and they're all going to be really interactive, fun. People are going to go home with a whole year's worth of ideas to bring back to their children, whether it's in the classroom or program or home.
Okay, and this is a multiple-day program, because I know that there's activities running on Friday evening, and there's Saturday presentations, too.
Right. So Friday night from 6 to 7 at Centennial Hall is the Open Community Family Night. So people can bring their preschoolers, and the topic's water, water, water. And the Franklin Science Institute, the traveling science team, is going to be here. It's kind of an exciting show to watch. And it also gives families and parents ideas for how to talk about nature and everyday life around them in a way that leads children into exploring and being excited about learning these topics. So sometimes I think, you know, people have had a negative experience themselves. Oh, I don't like math. Or I'm afraid of that. Or, oh, I thought that was boring. And I think if they come to these presentations, they're going to have a whole shift in the way they think about math and science and technology and engineering themselves. So that's what we're all for, is inspiring and motivating and educators, whether you're a parent or a kindergarten teacher or Head Start teacher or child care provider, preschool teacher. Everyone's invited. Come together, learn, explore, be excited.
Okay, and I know you're associated with the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia, a place that I know extremely well. I grew up just outside of Philadelphia in Norristown, and I've been to the Franklin Institute dozens of times. If anybody's never been there, they've got like a giant mock-up of a human heart, and you can actually walk through it.
Wow.
It's pretty cool.
That's probably
we need a children's museum here in Juneau. That would be a really great project.
That'd be a good project. Yeah,
yes.
It was pretty neat. And it's still there, although some of the older exhibits aren't there anymore. But
I know whenever our family traveled, we always looked for the site for the children's museums. And since we can't all travel and get everywhere, it's great that they're actually coming to us. So we'll have that opportunity to, you know, they'll bring a lot of their different materials and kind of how they're very dynamic. You know, there's three of them coming from the science team. They've just come back from China this year. They went to the International Science Fair and so festival. So that's another, you know, just really exciting opportunity.
Yeah, that museum's extremely hands-on. I mean, there is a lot of interactive exhibits in there now.
And that's really how
we learn. The way it was when I was younger. It was, you know, a lot of them were static, but now there's a lot of things that you can actually interact with.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty interesting. Plus, they have the very first planetarium I was ever in. I do volunteer work at the planetarium here in Juneau, but it's called the Fells Planetarium. That was the very first planetarium I've ever been in. So that's kind of where my love for astronomy came from.
Well, we have so much around us for science, you know, that it's a really exciting place to be, to explore the glaciers and the water and the
beaches.
There's
a lot here, yeah, or even figure out when low tide is and go out and look for starfish.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just something that you can do here. There's so many things that you have access to here that, you know, a lot of people think that this place is isolated, and yeah, it is. You can't drive out of here, but, I mean, there's so many things that are here that people can learn from. It's a pretty amazing location.
You know, the other thing I'd like to mention is it is a STEM-based conference, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math, and there's really only a handful of states that are really focusing on that. So that's a big, you're in the forefront for, having this type of emphasis and this goal for this conference, the science, technology, engineering, and math. And for teachers to see that when the kids are working with blocks and things, that is STEM. You know, the building that they do, it's STEM. Sometimes they don't even realize that they're doing STEM, and they are, the block building, which they've taken out of many classrooms, actually.
And the Juneau Economic Development Council has been our partner in planning this conference, and they are, of course, the lead agency for STEM in Juneau for the elementary schools and all the way up. And I just wanted to thank all the business community that are involved with science, technology, engineering, and math for their support, because it's really building this lifelong interest and excitement about the careers that later on they'll be coming in to be miners and engineers. And so I wanted to thank JEDC and Hecla Greens Creek Mining Company and Lakeshore Learning and Ron Zapakathiri and CORE Alaska, First National Bank, First Bank, Kai Environmental Consulting, and Murray & Associates, Wassman Associates, Northwind Architects, Hearthside Books, and LG Rayfield & Mertz.
Okay, Joy Lyon and Dr. Diana Grabowski. Last thing is remind everybody when this starts, because it's not tonight. It is...
So tomorrow, Friday morning, 8:30, yeah. Okay. And then Friday night, 6 to 7 p.m. for the family night.
Okay, and then events also on Saturday. There's presentations on Saturday as
starting at 8:30. Mm-hmm. And you can register at the door.
Okay, and where are these going to be held?
All at Centennial Hall.
All at Centennial Hall. Okay, thank you both very much again for being my guests in the studio today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My sails were set wing to wing. I had a jukebox graduate for first mate. She couldn't sail, but she sure could slam. And I pushed B-52 and bombed them with the blues. With my gear set stubborn on standing, I broke all the rules, straight my old high school. Never once gave thought to landing. I hid in the cloud and warmth of the crowd. When they said come down, I threw up. Ooh, rolling on.
Tired of paying those high heating bills month after month? Learn how to improve the comfort of your home while lowering your energy costs. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation is sponsoring free classes to help you increase your home's energy efficiency. Attend one or all of the classes March 27th through 30th at the UAS Technical Education Center. Register online at ahfc.us or call 907-980-6374. This message brought to you by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
Support comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, offering fresh roasted coffees since 1974 and proud supporters of public radio since 1987. Heritage Coffee, committed to community. Information online on Facebook or heritagecoffee.com.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. It's 3:51 p.m. I'm Ken Fix, your host, and my next guest is going to be Shelley Gill, and she's the author of Alaska Dog Heroes, True Stories of Remarkable Canines. Hi, Shelley. How are you?
Hi, Ken. I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing fine. And let me remark a little bit here. I have read the book. It's not very complicated. It's kind of thin and designed for children for the most part. But there's about 19 dogs that are featured in here, not just Balto, which most everybody recognizes.
Well, there are a lot of dogs in there, and some of them are really good friends of mine. It was a fun book to put together for Sasquatch Books, And I was pretty thrilled with the illustration. My longtime illustrator was not able to do the book at the time, so it was really neat to work with a gal who did do it, and I thought she did a wonderful job.
Yeah, the illustrations are really nice. So there's one that goes along with each story, and most of these stories are just a single page long. They're not very hard to read. So what motivated you to write a book about famous Alaskan dogs?
Well, I have a history with dogs in Alaska. I was one of the first women to race in the Iditarod, and one of the dogs that's featured in the book is Tekla, and that was Susan Butcher's dog. And Susan and I shared a tent together out at Goose Bay Road one winter, training a whole passel of sled dogs and sleeping on caribou hides and running outside in our long underwear and cutting wood in the fire. And so I wanted to kind of showcase some of the Alaska experiences that I've had and some of the really cool dogs that I've met. And as I did my research, I ran across just some really cool old photos that everything that's known has been forgotten. All that's left is just the picture. And you just wonder about some of these amazing pictures. But you know that dogs have always been such a huge, integral part of our lives up here. And it seems like a month doesn't go by that we don't read about some epic adventure where a dog saves somebody's life. I mean, this book came out like 2 weeks ago, and that was the week that a fellow was saved by his dog up in the valley. The dog laid on its on the man's chest all night after he fell off a snowmobile, and kept him alive until somebody came along and the dog went and got some other snow machines and brought him back, you know, and essentially saved the guy's life. And that's just a story I've heard over and over again. And I go back a ways. I've been in the state 42 years, and so I remember a lot of these stories.
Okay, Shelley, and what would be your favorite outside of Balto?
Oh, you know, my favorite would never be Balto. I'm an underdog for it. If you're going to put Togo in there, you got to put Balto in there. But Togo was the real hero. And I just think, you know, sometimes you just can't make this stuff up, that a guy from Jamaica this year saved the mushing mortician. But the fact that Togo is actually stuffed and in Iditarod headquarters is one of those amazing Alaskan stories, something you would only see up here. But Togo was like the unsung hero of the Serum Run and was a dog that led Leonard Seppala's team to many victories. And Balto was just kind of a blue-collar kind of guy. And he ended up stealing all the thunder from the Serum Run when Disney made the movie. But they actually were talking about the heroics of Togo.
Okay, I'm a little partial to the Patsy Ann story about the Bull Terrier and Juno.
Oh, well, you have to be being a Juno guy. I know, you know. And there is a book about Patsy Ann. It's just a lovely book. But you can't leave Patsy Ann out either, because she's just the coolest chick that ever hung out on a boardwalk in Juno. And I remember one of my editors saying, is it really fair to say she was, like, fed in the bars? And I was like, well, yeah, that's what she did. It was such a great story. She was a great dog.
All right. Yeah, the book is fabulous. It's got some great illustrations in it. It's only 32 pages long, and the stories are great.
All children's books are 32 pages long.
They're all 30. Some of them are shorter than that.
Yep.
All right. And I love this. And if you don't want it back, I got a 3-year-old grandson who would just love this.
So. Oh, hey, I would love for you to have it, you know. And I got to tell you, I was listening to your other interview, and the STEM conference sounds fabulous. I've been doing Anchorage school visits this week and talking to kids about a new app that is coming out on whales that I was part of. And it's all technology and engineering. Very exciting stuff happening right now in schools in Alaska.
Yeah, it sure is. All right, Shelley, thank you very much for being our guest on the Juno Afternoon today.
Hey, my pleasure. Take care, Ken.
You too, Shelley.
Bye.
Okay, buddy boys, we rumble. One weekend only.
Floyd Dryden Middle School presents the musical West Side Story, March 28th and 29th at 7 p.m., Sunday the 30th at 2 p.m. at Thunder Mountain High School.
Tickets are available at Floyd Dryden, Hearthside Books, Rainy Retreat Books, and at the door.
Don't miss it. West Side Story for one weekend only, March 28th, 29th, and 30th at Thunder Mountain High School.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon, 3:57 p.m. My guest now is Jeffra Clough from Eagle Crest. Welcome back, Jeffra.
Hey, thanks for having me this afternoon, Ken.
Okay, what's going on at Eagle Crest now?
Well, the forecast for this weekend is calling for sunshine and spring conditions, so we're pretty excited. On the schedule for this weekend is our second event of the Great Alaskan Terrain Park Series, the Slopestyle Competition. And you can find all the information on skijuno.com, but the Slopestyle is for all ages, all abilities, and it is on Saturday, March 29th. Registration starts at 8:45, practice is at 9:15, the jam is at 11, and the finals are at 1 o'clock. And again, you can find that information on skijuno.com. And this is our final week of five-day operations. Ken, we're starting to wind down, and spring is here.
Okay, and how much longer is the season going to run?
Well, we're open Thursday through Monday this week. Then we're closed Tuesday through Thursday, open for next weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And then our final weekend of operation will be April 13th and 14th, or excuse me, April 12th and 13th.
Okay, and is everything on track for the Porcupine Lodge construction?
Yep, everything's on track for the Porcupine Lodge construction. That construction will start on Monday, April 14th. So we're very excited, and we just want to remind everyone that the season is winding down, and don't stay away. It's amazing conditions up there. We've got a lot of snow. We've got bluebird days, and get out there and come on up and pay us a visit.
Okay, thanks again, Jeffra, for being my guest in the studio.
Thanks, Ken.
All right, our forecast this evening is calling for mostly clear skies tonight and lows around the upper teens to low 20s, except around 14 degrees in some wind-sheltered areas. Northeast winds at 10 to 25 miles an hour. The strongest winds will be near downtown Juneau and Douglas, of course, again. Tomorrow's forecast is partly cloudy with highs in the mid-30s. And this is KTOO in Juneau. We rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K201AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable Digital Channel 871, and we're also online at ktoo.org. And support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you. It was my pleasure to serve as your host today, and hope to see you again really soon. Good day.
Leadership is challenging truths that only a few weeks ago seemed self-evident, that in the 21st century, the borders of Europe cannot be redrawn with force.
President Obama in Brussels for talks with NATO and the EU.
It's Wednesday, March 26th, and this is All Things Considered.
I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Coming up, the latest moves on Ukraine.
Also, people who lived in the area of this week's catastrophic mudslide might have known about the years of scientific...